Hello and welcome into the Irish NFL show with me, Colm Cronin, and delighted to be joined by a returning guest. It is author, Raiders fan, Stephen O'Rourke. Steve, how are you doing, sir?
Good, Colm. How are you?
I'm not too shabby. I was thinking, you know, you were coming on and I was thinking, Steve, the Raiders, Manchester United, the Republic of Ireland. If it wasn't for the women's team making the World Cup, a very, very bleak decade, Steve.
It's one of those things where, like, it's hard to remember the joy of it all. I will say one thing, right? On Man United, at the very least, they're entertaining. They might be not great for your heart, your blood pressure, or, you know, your heart, but they're entertaining, say at least. And, you know, for better or worse, it feels like it keeps feeling like Ireland is about to turn a corner, isn't it? And then they just don't. With everything that's going on off the field as well, you know, this week with the how could you be worse than John Delaney? And somehow it was managed. It's a fun time to be a sports fan in this house, I can tell you.
I was discussing with somebody earlier in terms of, you know, the FAI and the level of incompetency, and was there anyone comparable? And the Jets were offered, and perhaps so. At least the Jets can point to a Super Bowl way back when. But we are here to talk about the Raiders, and there have been some changes, obviously, since you were last on, and interested in getting your take on those things. We may as well start with the Antonio Pierce confirmation and your thoughts on, you know, him taking up the role on a full-time basis, Steve.
I think the last time I was on, it was still kind of, you know, we were kind of discussing, you know, where this might land, and it did feel at the time that this was almost inevitable with the way the players, certainly, you know, I think Max Crosby threatened to look for a trade if Pierce wasn't appointed. And it does feel very much like a coach's pick or a player's pick as a coach. And that comes with, like, I personally think it comes with, like, a lot of, it's a very risk-reward, kind of high-risk, high-reward strategy because, like, you know, when the players are on your side and when the vibes are good, that's great. But when it comes to you lose three or four games in a row, like, you're not, that's not the kind of coach you're looking at for kind of turning it around. So I think the best thing about the Pierce hire is keeping Patrick Graham as defensive coordinator. I think that's huge. And again, there's a lot of people say, oh, Patrick Graham runs a very simple our defense. Having watched the Raiders defense for the past nearly three decades, simple is good. Simple is fine. We've tried to complicate it. It doesn't work. But I do think he has a year because I think Graham goes and finds a head coaching job somewhere next year. So I think Antonio Pierce has a year to prove himself as head coach. And I think you know all too well at the moment what it's like to be a team kind of in that middle of the pack. Not bad enough to get the quarterback you want and not good enough to challenge for the playoffs. I think he has to push it one way this year and he has to mount the playoff challenge. Going to be tough. I mean, he's arguably in one of the two toughest divisions in football in terms of competitiveness, in terms of teams. Like, you know, the Raiders can take games off the Chiefs and the Broncos can take games off. So, you know, it's a bit of a mad division in that regard. But overall, I think I'm happy enough with the hire. Just in terms of what was out there, I'm glad we didn't go after one of the bigger names because obviously we've just had that experience and it wasn't necessarily a good one. And I do think, you know, the Harbaugh thing, you know, I don't think it was ever a real opportunity for the Raiders. And I think it would have alienated a lot of people in-house when there was a really good potential head coaching candidate already in the chair, basically, to go after a name for the sake of going after a name. So I think that overall I'm happy enough with it. But I do, in the back of my mind, I know, like, again, going back to Manchester United, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, that that appointing coaches and managers on the basis of they know the culture, they know the locker room, it has to go well, because when it goes badly, it continues to go badly, and I think that's the bigger issue.
I was looking at it, obviously in the lead up to this, about the kind of interims who have been appointed or who've taken over since 2011 and who've been appointed into the full-time role. And we're not talking, a litany of greats. If you're to probably be on the optimistic side of things, and something that kind of came out of nowhere, Doug Marrone with the Jags, in some respects, is probably the most successful, though that didn't end so well. But in his, one of the things, I suppose, that really came out since the appointment was his comments around the Chiefs. And you very kindly said the Broncos can take games off the Chiefs. The Broncos have taken not even a number, a game off the Chiefs since Mahomes took over. But Pierce made his disdain for the Chiefs very clear, and he talked about there being Patrick Mahomes rules. Oh, it good move, bad move. Like, I from a fan's perspective, I can see the kind of rah-rah aspect to it. But do you want to be riling up Patrick Mahomes? What are your thoughts on it?
That's my thing, right? It's all well and good saying it maybe privately to your players and getting them riled up, saying it publicly, and then having to watch Patrick Mahomes put 50 points on you maybe twice in a season is where it could go badly wrong. Now, having said that, like, the Raiders Chiefs rivalry, and I use the word rivalry very loosely, because one team has been very successful and one hasn't, but actually in season the Raiders have lived with the Chiefs really well over the past few seasons. Even when the Raiders as an organization have been poor, they have played the Chiefs and Patrick Mahomes, I think, particularly well. Now, there's been the odd blowout, but when it's not a blowout, actually the Raiders have had a very, very decent record against them. I think if you look at the Kansas City team that played the Raiders over Christmas compared to the one that went and won the Super Bowl, like, very little changed, you know, in terms of the scheme that the Chiefs were running, in terms of offense, defense. It was just that the Raiders played them so well. I think they just set up really well. But the problem is, God, this is my third Man United reference in a row, but like, it's like setting your team up to just beat Man City. Well, that's not going to get you to be Nottingham Forest or Luton, you know? And I do think there's a little element of that to it. Like, Patrick Mahomes is a singular talent, and setting your entire team up to beat him and that team doesn't necessarily set you up for success against Brock Purdy or whoever the case may be. So I do think part of me, again, like, put my fan hat on, pure fan, kind of love it, because we should hate the Chiefs and we should hate the Broncos and we should hate the Chargers, and that's the whole point of rivalry, is to make enemies, quote unquote, like, of those teams. Because I do think when one team is so far ahead, like, of everyone else, and they're so far ahead of pretty much everyone else in the AFC, never mind within the AFC West, I do think you have to give yourself some sort of edge, right? But then, do you get into the driving the coach around the stadium, or standing around on the halfway line and planting the flag and all of that kind of stuff? I will say, going back to his original point, we all know there are Patrick Mahomes rules and there are rules for everybody else. Like, I mean, that's, you just have to watch football. So you don't have to be a fan of a rival team and have a disdain for Patrick Mahomes to know that. But I'm okay with certain quarterbacks getting certain protections, because you don't want Patrick Mahomes' career over at whatever age when he still has another 10 years to give the league and all the excitement that he brings as well. So I, in a way, I do get it. Of course, the Raiders fan in me screaming at the back of my mind saying, no, no. But like, look, it happens. It happens in every sport where, you know, the best of the best get a certain amount of leeway that everyone else doesn't. You know, I mean, Cam Newton said it for years that he didn't get protection that other QBs got, and he ended his career ended early, probably because of it, the amount of late hits he took, you know. Well, there was that, and there was, he was Cam Newton and all the other things he brought to a team, but it definitely had an impact. And I think, yeah, going back to the overall point, I think I would have preferred it being a private thing and maybe something that a player leaks or whatever, and he could deny it. He had plausible deniability, but coming out and just saying it, I think it just leaves you hostage to fortune. And I don't think anyone should do that to themselves.
Yeah, it's just an interesting one when Mahomes deliberately goes looking for ammunition and to give him that. I also will say, like, hating the Chargers, it's kind of impossible. They, you know, they're just they're too cute.
I don't know. The only way I can think about not hating the Chargers is that Don Draper meme of "I don't think about you at all." I mean, that's
it. I mean, imagine a team that had the number one offense, number one defense, and didn't go anywhere. I just find them, they're the fluffy bunny. They're more Spursy than Spurs.
That's fair. No, that's fair.
They would be the team Harry Kane would play for if he was to play in the NFL. That was the other piece, and this kind of ties in maybe to the offseason, but just to take it as standalone, is obviously, and talking about the Chargers leads into it, because former Chargers GM Tom Telesco decamped to Las Vegas, and I can't say there were too many Chargers fans lamenting his loss. But your thoughts on it, Steve? I know my feeling as a Broncos fan, I never feared the Chargers.
No.
And so I'm wondering, in terms of when you bring somebody like that in to construct the roster, and GMs generally get a longer tenure than head coaches. I mean, if things go wrong, chances are they move off of Pierce, they get somebody else. But GMs tend to get 3-4 years, even if things are going very badly. Can he learn lessons? Is there any optimism there for you?
Not a huge amount of optimism. I have to say, I was quite high on Champ Kelly. I think a lot of the talk in house was really, really positive around Kelly, and I really thought he was the one who was going to get the role. It's always difficult to know what an assistant general manager actually accomplishes, right? So, you know, for all the criticism of Ziegler, like, it seemed to be that Kelly was immune from some of that criticism, and any good decision taken during the Ziegler tenure was appropriated to Champ Kelly. And so it is difficult, and I do get the thing about not wanting a rookie head coach and a rookie general manager, but, like, I mean, it's not as if they went out and got someone with a proven track record, you know? Outside of really obvious draft picks that they had to make, I thought about this at the time when he was pointed. Could I name a single Chargers surprise draft pick that they nailed? And I couldn't, right? Now, in terms of Herbert and things like that, he got the ones he had to get right, okay? That's fair enough. But, like, that almost felt can't miss. And so, for someone with the amount of experience as he has, it's amazing that you can still refer to Telesco as a kind of unknown quantity. Because, again, free agency, can you name a single kind of standout Chargers free agency signing? Now, free agency is difficult. You know, it's rare that a player comes in and makes a massive impact. We kind of all know that. But at the same time, there's just, if you've that many question marks over the experienced guy, why not just bite the bullet and take the risk with the guy who doesn't have the experience, but who has the belief of the head coach, who has the seemingly the backing of the players? So if it felt like I don't know. It felt a bit like, you know, Al Davis. It felt a bit like, you know, taking a 60-1 shot. You had the 60-1 shot in the Grand National and you backed it each way, but actually decided that you'd put like the mortgage on, you know, the each way favorite or something like that. At the beginning, I don't know gambling in the horses, but it felt like he was hedging his bet, is the point that long labored point that I was trying to make there. And you know, Mark Davis has a lot of things going for him. And I don't mean that just with the Raiders. I think he's doing a phenomenal job with the Aces. I think there's a lot to be said for, you know, a lot of people at Oakland probably won't agree with it, but he's doing a lot in terms of, you know, not just focusing on the football team and maybe keeping his hands out of a lot of the day-to-day stuff, which is great because he should be not involved in that. But I do think sometimes he feels like he went big with Gruden. He feels like he went big with McDaniels. And now this feels like everything has gone the opposite way. He swung too conservative with a lot of these decisions. And I think that's ultimately what informed it. But yeah, I'm worried at how little evidence you can point to kind of go, oh yeah, the Raiders are going to nail this draft. They're going to nail free agency, all of those things. So yeah, it's a tough one.
Yeah, I mean, in terms, I suppose, of, you know, not taking the wild swing, that kind of came a little bit in free agency, but on the biggest and probably possibly best name out there in terms of players usually come into free agency. And there, it can work. I mean, the Broncos defense back when they won the Super Bowl was built in part on free agency. But generally, there are questions around injuries and for the you know, reasons why guys get cut. For Christian Wilkins, it was just Miami find themselves in a situation where they can't pay everybody. He was out there. There was all the talk that, you know, this was going to be one of the super kind of perennial Super Bowl contenders. We're going to add this guy. He was going to be a finishing piece for them. And up stepped the Raiders. You know, the headline grabbing number, 4 year, $110 million, etc. But yeah, were you surprised? Are you happy that the thoughts on the Raiders making the biggest of splashes in this year's free agency?
It was a statement move. Like, I mean, we always say QB money. But I think when you look at that defense, and as I said, they've probably got another year of Patrick Graham. I wonder how much that played a factor in it as well. Like, get the most out of this guy before he moves on. I think it's a great signing. I was surprised. I have to say, admittedly, when I got the text, I have a Dolphin sporting friend, and he texted me about it, and I thought he was joking, because there isn't. Why wouldn't he end up with someone who could actually win a Super Bowl this year? But like, again, the concern is then, in the back of my mind, is like, why the Raiders? Like, obviously the money helps, but then what's he going to give to it if he knows he's only there for the money? I don't know if he's only there for the money at all. That Anna would be unfair of me to kind of say that. But you would have to question, I'd always question, and this is not just in this particular instance, why someone would sign with a middle of the pack team and not a Super Bowl challenging team when they have their pick. Now, there's two ways that could go. He thinks that he could be the difference maker on the Raiders defense that will help them, you know, get to the, you know, the AFC championship game. I don't think so myself. Or the other side is that, well, it's a lot of money. It's very hard to say no to. And it's just very hard to see a middle ground of those two. But again, I wonder, like, As a Broncos fan, when you saw that trade, like, what was your feeling? Was it more towards the there's a guy chasing bag, or there's a guy who feels like the Raiders could potentially turn into a Super Bowl challenging team?
It felt more the chasing the bag a little bit, though. In some ways, I do think having Patrick Graham helps, right? Because he is very well respected, and people did see it. Having Max Crosby, and maybe he's looking at that. And that's what he's thinking. But I get it, the NFL career, you know, we look at the QBs who tend to have longer careers, and sometimes you look at players, you know, been in the league a lot, but for an awful lot of guys, it can end very quickly, very suddenly. And so there is an aspect of that. But at the same time, I think he is a very good player. This is not when the Broncos went out and signed Juwan James from the Dolphins and gave him enormous money, and he came with huge concerns for injury concerns, which proved, you know, to be a piece. But it would be difficult for me to think any player can look at, you know, be same as people signing with the Broncos, that you could look at it and say, oh yeah, this is a team who are going to contend. Because and this is maybe a way to get into it, like the Raiders, like QB room at the moment, granted, it looks a lot better than the Broncos QB room, where you know, Jarrett Stidham and Ben DiNucci. But in terms of the draft and in terms of that piece, like, what would you like to see the Raiders do, Steve, in terms of that kind of, well, let's talk QB and then we'll get into the draft a little bit more. But obviously QB is what everyone is talking about. Do you see a situation where the Raiders try to trade up? Is that what you'd like them to do? Or do they stand pat? Do they take a QB later in the draft? Or do they just run it with Aiden O'Connell and Jarrett Stidham? Because there's an awful lot of talk out there. I saw today, you know, there was talk about Antonio Pierce wants to get up and he wants to see if Jaden Daniels. I equally saw talk that if Michael Penix is, they would be willing to take him with 13. It's lying season. It's guessing season. This is a period of time where QBs get talked up ridiculous. I mean, Will Levis was supposed to go second overall last year. Malik Willis was going to go, you know, potentially top five a few years ago. But your thoughts as to what you might like to see the Raiders do at QB?
I am never a fan of trading up. So I think there is a worst case scenario, and you kind of mentioned it. So I don't think A, they will trade up, and B, I struggle to see how they could, unless you throw Davante Adams in with, you know, future first round picks. That's the only way I can see them even managing to move up. So I kind of have the top sort of three or four guys ruled out. I don't think they get near any of those. I do think you wait. I think if you're in that 13 position, I don't think you can go after Penix. I think it's just too rich. I'm okay with him in the second round. Like, if any team knows that you can pick up an exceptionally valuable quarterback in the second round, it's the Raiders. They had, you know, years of Derek Carr providing better quarterback play than, I would say, at least half the league. In some years, it was more than three quarters of the league. And there was a second rounder. And I think there has to be a certain amount of patience that, again, defensively, they're probably on a much shorter time scale than they are offensively, and that's a difficult thing to kind of manage as well. O'Connell's not the answer. I think it's pretty clear from the sample size last year that O'Connell's not the answer. I thought the Minshew signing was interesting in the sense that, again, not someone you would hand the keys to. But someone you're happy, well, sorry, not someone you'd hand the keys to if you had a choice, but someone you're very happy to kind of let take over if things go a bit wrong, which they possibly can with either a rookie QB or Aiden O'Connell. I believe the Penix interest, from everything I've read, is very, very real. I'm just hoping they can see the value in other positions and other areas of need, of which they have, at 13, and hope that he's still there in the second round. I don't think I've read a credible draft analyst who've had him as an early or mid first round QB. I think the earliest I've seen anyone justify him is kind of in the the 28 to 30 range and someone trading up to there. And that's okay. I'm okay with someone trading a relatively early second round pick with a for a late first round pick. I mean, the Patriots for years were the kings of doing that, right? Going up and getting the guy they wanted. The Ravens, obviously, famously with Lamar Jackson and things like that. So I think there's a value in that. I do think what's also in their favor and what I hope they're thinking is that of the teams around them who need a QB, the Raiders are the ones with a second round pick. A lot of the teams around them don't. And I think that's what they have to look at. They have to look at that benefit and the beauty of that. Now, of course, teams can trade up and get that second round pick, and they can't, there's not much the Raiders can do about that. But that's an advantage, right? There are very few advantages a team picking at 13 can have over anyone else around them. But having a second round pick when the teams around you who need a QB don't, that's hugely, hugely valuable. The latest I've seen kind of coming towards the Raiders is that Penix will be gone by 44. Someone will have traded up at the back end of the first to take him. And that Bo Nix is the one who falls to the Raiders. I mean, again, he's a quarterback that I think people talk themselves into his upside. And a lot of the comps kind of go along the Jalen Hurts kind of thing. I think that's mostly to do with the transfer and all of that. But like, he does feel like someone, like he played more than 60 games as a starter in college. There's a lot of throws in that arm, and a lot of mileage in the legs. And I'm kind of, but the flip side of that is someone who has seen, probably, again, it's college compared to the NFL and everything moves a lot faster, but he's kind of seen it all. He's tough, which obviously is a key trait in Raiders QBs and always has been. It's just the market. It's a mark of the franchise. So, I mean, I wouldn't be unhappy if Bo Nix was the QB choice I think it's 44, isn't it, in the second round. I prefer if Penix fell that far. I don't think he will, but I do think, yeah, in order of scenarios, I think picking Penix at 13 is the worst case. Trading up and getting, you know, at least the thing is, right, you're not getting one in the top two, right? So you're trading up for the third guy. And is that ever a wise move as well? So I think patience, it's not exciting. It's not sexy, but patience is the key here. They're not a rookie QB away. Again, going back to what we were talking about just a few minutes ago, there are too many pieces that need to fall into place for the Raiders to become challengers that it's worth, you know, throwing the house at a QB in the first round when there are definitely other slots that need to be filled. So yeah, that's how I would like to see it go. Again, like, who knows? Like, you know yourself, the draft boards are wild. You have people who spend months and months doing 7-round, you know, mock drafts. And then all it takes is like one trade in the first round and everything goes out the window. So you never know how it might end up. But I really wouldn't like to see them pick a QB, any QB at 13, because I think the real good ones are gone at that stage.
Yeah, you know, as you said, I can see value if you really like somebody in trading up, but you have to have a plan. Like, you really have to, it has to be the guy you want and not, you know, not just because you need a QB and he has potentially the skill set. I mean, I do think that, you know, you had the Chiefs going up for Holmes and the Bills going up for Allen. But both of those were, the Chiefs were perennial playoff team. They had a plan for what they wanted to do, and Patrick Mahomes was highly coveted. Josh Allen, despite the fact that some people tried to tell you that he only came good in his third year, it's ridiculous. There were people saying, before the year before he went that he should be the number one overall pick. Indeed, Mel Kiper had him going as the number one overall pick in the lead up to the draft. And people say he was the most talented QB they'd seen. So I just think if the right talent is there, absolutely go up. But going up for the sake of going up and equally taking QBs at 12 and 13, I think there's a lot of talk at this time of year. I would be amazed if more than four QBs go in the first round. And I think
you're right. I think the only chance is that someone trades up for Penix or Nix late in the first round. But I think, and do you know what? Four might not even go. Although I haven't said that, if McCarthy is there late on in the draft, I think someone trades up for him. Because he feels like a first round QB, right? So I do feel like someone slides a little bit further than people expect, but I don't think massively so.
Yeah, well, it will be interesting to see. I might switch gears a little bit, Steve, just to get your thoughts on a couple of other things, because I am conscious of your time as well. But you worked in the journalism world. You covered the NFL a little bit, and it's been quite a year for the NFL media, shall we say. You have and the NFL themselves moving off a journalist who dared to ask some awkward questions. But then you have a sideline reporter coming out and saying, hey, I just used to make up the quotes. And, you know, there's no repercussions to that. You have insiders, you know, who we have gone, and I don't know if you've noticed this, but one of the things that the NFL insiders themselves have really had to kind of ramp up the what they are saying in relation to teams and there was one part around Tom Telesco where they had to say Ian Rappaport said Telesco built one of the NFL's best rosters over a decade with the rival Chargers when he went, and that's not a shot at the Raiders. That's just what that was what I noticed. And then Tom Pelissero said about Matt Patricia. Matt Patricia took on Blake Alling. This is last season. Last month, under difficult circumstances, running someone else's scheme with a depleted unit, he'll be a top DC candidate. Matt Patricia. Somebody said that. Tom Pelissero said that in 2024. That's an actual thing that was said. I suppose I've noticed that creep in. I am very cynical when it comes to the media, the coverage, and everything else. I'm interested in your thoughts on where NFL media coverage and the NFL media landscape is at.
It's not in a great place, I think. I think that's very fair. I think one of the biggest issues is a league covering itself is never a good thing, right? As you said, there are vested interests at play. There are owners that don't like looking bad. And there's some, like, don't get me wrong, there are some absolutely good people working within NFL media. I think Patrick Claibon is really good. He's really good, not just on football issues. He's really good on social issues and stuff like that. And that's not, it's not a slight or a shot at any of those. But anybody who works for the organization they're supposed to be covering is automatically compromised, right? So there's automatically a pinch of salt you have to take behind the news. And then you get to the insiders bit, who, like, insiders only exist if they make the people feeding them the information look good. So you're already in a situation where, well, okay, so they get this story, but why? They get it because they stop another story coming out, a story that makes the owner or the team or a player look bad. there are times you read Rappaport or Schefter and you read their tweets or you listen to them on broadcasts and you can hear the agent. Like, you can literally hear the agent. And it strikes me as an horrendous way, A, to live your life, right? Because you're constantly on. You know, was it the... there was a big trade a couple of years ago, I'm remembering, and literally someone missed it because they put their phone down to sing their kid happy birthday or something like that, right? And that's how cutthroat it is, right? You miss a massive break, and you're late. You're 20 seconds late to tweet, you know. So part of me goes, I don't know how anyone can live that life. But I do think it's symbolic of the kind of. I don't think the appetite is there to people. I want to be really conscious about what I say because there's a lot of people who only want to read and hear good things about the team they support, and I think you really see that on Twitter. And it's really funny at this time of year to watch certain accounts and certain people and how joyous and positive they are and how much they go digging for the good news around their team. And when we live in 2024, the good news for them is that there's so much content out there, they can always find the one that makes their team look great, that makes, you know, their predictions look right. And it's at the expense of, well, what is the actual story here, you know? So that's what always comes back to me. I find the idea of breaking news fascinating because I know from firsthand experience, the only reason anyone ever gets a scoop is because someone is pissed off with somebody else and they want to release a certain amount of information, right? There's a reason why John Delaney, going back to our original message about the FAI, is no longer in his role as FAI chief executive. And that's because he annoyed one person too many within the FAI, and that person showed Mark Tighe where all the bodies were buried. It doesn't come from... I think people think these scoops come from like Watergate-style investigations. The secret is you just need to find the right person who's annoyed with their boss. And that's where you get most of this information. But a lot of that doesn't come out, right? Because certain people in very influential positions are paid to release the good news, you know? Look at the Rice situation with Kansas City, right? Very, very few in-depth dives into what has happened there, right? This is a Kansas City team whose head coach's son was involved in a very serious incident just before a Super Bowl. This is a team who knowingly drafted a person who choked and punched his pregnant partner. And actually, that player was fundamental in helping them get to multiple Super Bowl appearances. There's a team with a huge amount of culture issues. You would never know that if you were just following NFL media. You would think the Chiefs are this brilliantly run franchise. The Hunt family who own them are, you know, the perfect owners. And that's my issue with it all. Is that, and again, I'm not picking on just the Chiefs. Every team has issues, right? There was a website that literally used to track which NFL teams had players under arrest at that moment in time. You know, it's not like it's unique to them, but it just goes to show. But they're the darlings of the NFL. They've got, you know, the probable best player in football, the defending Super Bowl champions, arguably one of the top three coaches of all time as head coach. Very difficult to paint them as the bad guys, and yet increasingly that's what they look like. They look like a franchise who consistently draft or are involved in incidents that any other team would get rightly criticized for. And so I think that's just, I guess, one example of where NFL media is failing at the moment, because I have to read British websites or Irish websites to get the rice, kind of the latest rice news. And it's just one of those things where I really struggle with why that's the case. How did we get here, right? Because I think you and I have very similar interest in good journalism, right? We grew up reading the same kind of journalists, the same sports writers who really cared about the story. And now and I think it's kind of the same in politics and it's kind of the same in soccer. Everything is an obsession with access now. And so that's why people don't want to say the bad news or give the bad news.
Yeah, and because you see the consequences, I think, of what happens when you do. My concern about it is that even the bigger podcasts and talk about just content, and this is great for content, and that's what tends to drive it, rather than taking a deep dive into something or doing investigative journalism, or even and I say this, I know we touched on this, but I like Wright Thompson is beloved in American media, and nobody talks about the glaring errors that he has made. Or if they do, it's just like, why are they complaining about that? And it's not once, it's repeated. And it's things as basic as getting the number of Super Bowls that Bill Belichick has won wrong. Like, that is a fundamental piece that you could just go and look up. And I am very concerned about where the media is headed, because it just seems that, again, even when, say, the New York Times bought The Athletic and basically said no politics, you're cutting off a lot of avenues. But you mentioned there in terms of owners, and definitely the back end of the podcast has taken a turn, but you can't ignore it. Like, this is a league where teams now go for billions and billions of dollars, and every team that comes on the market is going to go for more than previous. Is I suppose Saudi ownership of a team inevitable? I mean, and is that where sport is headed?
Well, it's who can afford teams, right? And we are getting to a stage where, in the vast majority of cases, it's even becoming too expensive, I can't believe I'm saying this, for billionaires to buy sports teams. The only thing that I think kind of puts the kibosh on Saudi ownership of an NFL team is that the entire Saudi project seems to be about getting as many of those teams to either appropriate Saudi culture, so like the Newcastle third jersey, playing Saudi Arabia games in St. James' Park, or having events in Saudi Arabia, right? It's a lot more difficult to host an NFL game in Saudi Arabia than it is to host a preseason friendly, or, you know, the Grand Prix was already kind of, you know, there and stuff like that. But that said, money talks, right? Money absolutely talks. And if you can have a game, if you can organize a game in Brazil or Mexico or Germany or the UK, I guess logistically it's probably not as difficult, or it's the same level of difficulty to organize a game in Saudi Arabia. Now, what I will say is I don't know what the appetite for American football or the NFL is in Saudi Arabia. I know it's huge in all the countries that they are playing international games in today, right? So that is a factor. But again, I keep going back to the primary goal of every single NFL owner is to make as much money as they can before winning a Super Bowl. Right, it is ahead of winning a Super Bowl. So anything that that will line their pockets, especially the poorer ones, because they're not, again, you know, it's depending on when you bought your team, you might not necessarily be able to play with some of the bigger owners within the NFL. I mean, Mark Davis is a prime example of that, one of the poorer billionaires within the league, and arguably probably only a billionaire on paper, you know. So I get it. I can, and it does feel like sport is going in a direction that I don't think anybody other than those who are benefiting directly from it, like, you know. I work with a woman from Newcastle, and her dad was like, is a passionate, diehard Newcastle United fan. And we were having a conversation about the ownership one day, and she was like, I completely get why people are against it. I completely understand the human rights element of it. I completely understand all of that. She said, my dad has been a Newcastle United supporter 50 years, has gone to every home game bar one or two for 30 of those years. Why should he have to give up his fandom of that team because the ownership that he can't control has changed? And I do understand that point of view, but the reason sports washing works is because people say, oh yeah, but I'm different. You know, my fandom won't have an impact, but it will. We have an all too real world example at the moment of boycotting and how it has an effect and how it works, right? In a much more serious case. But it does work. People voting with their bums and voting with their wallets works. And I think that what ultimately lets the Saudi project and all these petro state owners win is that there are enough people who are happy to say, oh yeah, but not me, I'm different. Kind of sad. Like, again, I people will say, oh, it's really easy for you to say. Like, I didn't watch a minute of the World Cup in Qatar because I was against the whole thing. I would be as difficult as I find watching Manchester United right now, I would have been done with them had Qatari ownership bought them, right? I don't need my enjoyment on a Saturday to be at the expense of, you know, human rights. I just don't. I would much rather just enjoy my sport. And that's the thing I hate is that ownership, and it's not even a minority of ownership anymore. It's still a minority, but it's an ever burgeoning minority, has made so many things that we love turn into complicated moral decisions and questions. And that's like, we go to work, we pay our bills, we relax and enjoy ourselves, and you hope to leave, if you can't leave a good mark, you hope to leave no mark, right? And in your life. And you're faced every Saturday and every Sunday with these fundamental moral questions now as a fan. It's such a challenge. And I hate that. I hate the inevitability that the NFL will move the same way. And look, don't get me wrong. Like, I mean, it's not as if NFL ownership has a completely clean slate as it is for many reasons. But yeah, it's just that constant grappling with right or wrong when all you want to do is sit down and watch the sport you love. It's tough, and it's coming to it, it. The thing is, golf, tennis, Formula One, football, coming to the sport you love, whether you like it or not. And that's the inevitability of it is the saddest part of it all, I think.
Yeah. And it's not, I think there are a number of different aspects to it. It's on a base level, it's any nation state. Like, the idea that Ireland would own a team or a league, it just seems so bizarre. And then you add in all the others. But yeah, I mean, look, you had Dan Schneider, and he, you know, he was protected for years. So it'll be interesting to ultimately see where it ends up going. But Steve, for people out there who want to check out, you know, your stuff, you had a fantastic book come out last year. What are there things that you are working on currently, or where should people go if they want to read your music?
You've asked a very delicate question because yeah, my wife just walked by as you were asking that question, and I've started 5 books since that book came out, and I've yet to finish any of them, right? And I can't explain it. I just get an idea, I write for ages, and then I stop. But something is in the pipeline. I can't sports related, sports biography related, but it's still very, very early days. For the most part, Twitter still, despite its, or sorry, X, despite its being in its death role, I'm still there, Steve O'Rourke, O-H, Rourke. But I am hoping to do a bit more writing, as the new NFL season comes in. Had this, the almost the opposite of what the New York Times told The Athletic. I had this idea of how to weave an NFL preview each week into political or cultural musings. I'd done it before, but I might start it up again this year because I've got that bug again to write. But that's pretty much it. Nothing official yet, but maybe the next time I'm on, I might have more news in that regard.
Well, we look forward to hearing, you know, maybe about what's in the works, and would definitely advocate checking out Steve over on Twitter. It is always entertaining, and I just want to thank you for taking the time to chat to me this evening, Steve.
No, thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening. And if you're enjoying the show, please do vote with your fingers and rate, review, or subscribe on whatever podcast platform you're listening on. Every click, every like, every positive review, and every additional subscriber makes a huge difference. It helps others to find the show, and we really do appreciate it. We'd also love to hear from you and to interact with NFL fans on our social channels, wherever you're listening in the world, so please do get in touch.